Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Klass as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, and hear from the minds transforming healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more with the help of AI. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. The future of wireless is here, and it's transparent. Switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless visible. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. No hidden fees, no surprises, no, really.
What are you waiting for? Get with the times and switch to Visible at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan for data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
What kind of fun is waiting for you at Kings Island? The holy cow, we're way too high and here comes the drop kind of fun. The make a splash all summer kind of fun. The I can't believe I ate that whole funnel cake. Let's get another kind of fun. But most importantly, at Kings Island, you'll find for the fun of it kind of fun.
Don't wait to start your fun season. Kings Island is now open on weekends.
Welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind from HowStuffWorks.com.
Hey, welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind. My name is Robert Lamb.
And I'm Joe McCormick, and it's the holidays. We know what we do during the holidays, at least here in the United States of A. You put a lot of stuff in your body that maybe shouldn't be there.
That's right. You eat. You have these various feasts that are all about getting through the winter ahead, getting through the cold, dark winter, and surviving to the spring. It's a riot as old as human history, and we're still doing it.
Yeah. Even with nasty, weird contraptions like candy canes.
Yes.
I have a question. Does anybody really like candy canes?
I'm sure my son would like them if we steer him away from it. Like, he got a candy cane at some event recently and brought it home, and we kind of convinced him that actually this is a candy that is best served hanging on the tree. This is more of a decoration, really.
That's a candy you don't even have to lie to him to discourage him about. You just be like, this will cut your tongue and you're gonna be sad you ate it. Your mouth will feel weird and you'll have injuries.
Yeah, it doesn't have the hyper marketing of many modern candies, because we limit the amount of candy that my son eats. And that means at Halloween, he had access to all of these candies, but then he traded them into the Switch Witch and got a toy in exchange. But there were some candies that were just so well marketed, he was convinced they were his favorite. Like Ike and Mike, for some reason.
Ike and Mike?
Yeah.
Marketed? Do they have marketing?
Well, I mean, they have the...
It's Mike and Ike, right?
Mike first. Yeah, I don't know those guys that well, so I forget which one comes first. But the package is like bright green, and there are these colors, and he's instantly connecting with it, and he's saying, oh, this one's good. Look, those are fruits on there. It's bright. It's potent. I want to eat that. That's my favorite candy. He's never actually had it.
Huh. Well, okay. So today's episode is going to be a sequel to our last episode about dangerous foods that aired last year. And so today is Dangerous Foods 2, The Revenge. No, the second course. the return of the food.
There was
never
course.
A good thing.
Yes.
Yes. A dish best served cold. And there is going to be a lot of wonderful, dangerous, poisonous weirdness out there to talk about. Mm-hmm. But We do want to say at the beginning that at least I feel deeply, Robert, I hope you feel the same way, that being alarmist is very much against the stuff to blow your mind ethos.
Right.
So we are not going to tell you there is a silent killer lurking in your pantry. that save that for those websites that demonize MSG and stuff mm-hmm. we've already debunked. This episode is going to be about dangerous and poisonous misadventures involving rare foods, everyday foods, but no matter what case it is, it's not designed to scare you. But it should be a reminder that we live in a world of very complex and sometimes fragile biochemical interactions. And for those of us living in industrialized countries, I think sometimes our consumer mindset leads us to believe that our food should meet the industry quality control standards you'd get in the dead products you buy at Walmart.
Right.
Or IKEA, maybe. So if every version of the same product number table at IKEA really is the same, no matter which IKEA you go to anywhere in the world, shouldn't every baked potato be the same everywhere you go in the world? But it's not, is it? I mean, the foods we eat are organisms or substances derived from organisms, plants, animals, fungi. And as much as we might like our food products to be contained and tamed and dependable as the output of a furniture factory, as we all know, sometimes life finds a way.
Yeah, I mean, these are organisms. Now, in some cases, especially with various fruits and whatnot, it is the organism's game for you to eat it. It wants you to eat it. But in many other cases, the organism does not want to be eaten and has certain biological systems in place to prevent it, to discourage it, to make it difficult for you to carry this this act of gluttony out.
Mm-hmm.
And also, any type of food that is produced, if it's, you know, a grown part of a thing's body, or it comes out of the soil, or a creature makes it, it is the end of a production line. A
yeah.
production line that
is not standardized.
Exactly, exactly.
No, it depends on the region. It depends on the environment, the climate, the conditions, what materials are available for the organism to work with. So, yeah, biochemistry is a deep web of complex interactions. And the stuff we're getting is not fresh. It's the process. It's the end of a very long process. And it's just very common around the world in various ways for something weird to happen somewhere along that process.
Right. All right. So what's first up? What's the first course here, Joe?
Okay. Well, I want to tell you a story.
Okay.
So in his work known as the Anabasis, the ancient Greek historian Xenophon tells a story from his time as a general in the Greek war against the Persians. And one of his accounts tells of a story that took place in 401 BCE. While Xenophon and his troops are returning home from battle with a group, Xenophon's got about 10,000 Greek fighters with him, and they're traveling through Colchis, which is a region along the coast of the Black Sea in what is now the country of Georgia. And Xenophon's troops come across a place that is swarming with thousands of bees. There are just bees everywhere. And you might think, oh, that sounds horrible. But for a bunch of Greek soldiers, this is actually good news, because they knew they're in for a treat. Fresh honey from the hive.
That's right. They weren't packing any candy canes or Ike and Mike.
Ike and Mike.
Well, maybe it was reversed back then. I don't know how the ancient Greeks rolled.
The Greek alphabet.
Yeah.
Did I come before M? I'm not sure.
At any rate, they probably weren't getting their sweet tooth satisfied quite like they would wish it to be.
You know, I comes before M in our alphabet.
Our apologies to the manufacturers of this candy.
A little bit of brain problems here with me. Anyway, so the Greek fighters, they've got honey, delicious, right? But after eating the honey, the soldiers started to give off signs of a strange reaction. And so Xenophon writes that the soldiers began to go out of their heads, and they suffered from diarrhea and vomiting. Then the soldiers collapsed to the ground and wallowed about as if dead drunk. And in some cases, they seemed to have lost their minds. In others, the men were like men on their deathbeds. Xenophon writes, quote, "So they lay there in great numbers as though the army had suffered a defeat, and great despondency prevailed. On the next day, however, no one had died, and at approximately the same hour as they had eaten the honey, they began to come to their senses, and on the third or fourth day they got up as if from a drugging."
Ooh, bad honey.
So what happened? Yeah, had the local bees risen up against them? No, Xenophon's fighters had stumbled into a trove of the substance well known to inhabitants of the Black Sea coast, mad honey.
Oh.
This is what the ancients called it. Pliny called it, I forget the term now. I think it's melimenomenon, the honey that is a mad maker.
Oh, I like that.
And there are other ancient accounts of mad honey poisoning. So in 67 BCE, the Roman military leader Pompey the Great is taking a Roman army near the southern shore of the Black Sea again, while chasing the Persian army of King Mithridates of Pontus. And the Persians, they've got a group of allies, apparently, who know about the mad honey, and these allies set a trap for Pompey's army. They place honeycombs full of mad honey from the local bees into containers and left them along Pompey's path, knowing that some of the soldiers would not be able to resist a sweet indulgence. And they were right. The Romans were basically Winnie the Pooh. They were Pooh Bear. Whoa, I've got to get the honey. So many Roman troops ate the honey. They became incredibly sick and disoriented, went out of their heads, while the Romans were wallowing around, you know, in a bit of a sugary stupor. Mm-hmm. The Persian army came back, killed him.
Oh.
Led to a battle with very asymmetrical outcome. I've read that more than 1,000 Roman soldiers were killed and very few Persians died.
A very asymmetrical outcome. That's a wonderful kind of military euphemism.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah, a little bit of a callback there. I think the term would be a massacre.
Yeah.
Actually, that's the non-euphemistic.
A honey glazed massacre. Yes.
A sticky massacre. But there's an excellent article on mad honey. Actually, I came across by none other than Adrian Mayer. If you remember from our episode on geomythology.
Oh, okay.
Adrian Mayer is the main scholar we talked about in that episode, and she's known for the theory that various mythological beasts were inspired by ancient peoples coming across dinosaur fossils. So, for example, people in Central Asia may have found Triceratops remains in the Gobi Desert, mm-hmm. and this led to the creation of griffin myths. And so we talked about her in that episode, but she has this article in a 1995 edition of Archaeology Magazine called Mad Honey. It's a great read. You can look it up online. But she talks about also how in AD 946, a ruler of the Kievan Rus called Olga of Kiev, who in general, I looked her up. She seems like she's pretty BA. She's like bad. She's cool. She used fermented honey from the Black Sea region to poison a group of about 5,000 of her enemies and then had them massacred.
Oh, wow. So there's a long history of military missteps or outright poisonings and massacres with mad honey.
Yeah. And with all these ancient accounts, I mean, you have to wonder to what extent we're getting the true story.
Right.
But these are the accounts as presented by these ancient historians and authors.
Because I can also see where this would be a narrative to invoke if you're on the losing side.
Right.
You know, to say, well, yes, our troops were massacred, and our troops were ambushed, but they were also poisoned by this local honey
because I was a bad commander.
Yeah.
Right. But we do know now that this is totally plausible, mm-hmm. because mad honey is absolutely a real thing. And mad honey, the problem is not the bees themselves, but the flowers they pollinate. So in the Black Sea coastal region, bees often consume huge quantities of nectar from the flowers of the rhododendron plant. Hmm. And rhododendrons produce a potentially deadly neurotoxin called grayanotoxin. So I'm going to be referring to a paper published in Cardiovascular Toxicology by Suze A. Jansen et al. Called Grayanotoxin Poisoning, Mad Honey Disease and Beyond from 2012. And what they report is that grayanotoxin is also known as andromedotoxin, acetylandromedol, and rhodotoxin. And it can be derived from the body parts of plants in the family Ericaceae, which includes rhododendron, Pieris, agarista, and kalmia. And in reality, grayanotoxin is a family of related toxins. So there are a bunch of different grayanotoxins. We should probably speak about it in the plural. There are more than 25 isoforms that have been derived from rhododendron. And here's the basic way it works in your body. So granotoxins are poisonous because of their ability to bind to the group 2 receptor site in voltage-gated sodium channels, or VGSCs. And so I'll break that down basically. VGSCs are protein structures. They're little structures within the body that span across membranes, and they facilitate the transfer of sodium ions, which is charged particles of sodium. And so the transfer of these charged particles is important for communication between the body's different tissues, allowing the passage of action potential in cells like neurons. If you introduce a toxin that binds to receptor sites in these sodium channels, you can essentially prevent effective communication between body tissues and disrupt the nervous system. Specifically, the researchers think that granotoxins work by preventing the inactivation of the sodium channel. To use a metaphor, it would be like leaving the light switch stuck in the on position.
Okay.
You can imagine how this would have negative systemic effects on the nerve cells and the body at large. But specifically, the authors think it probably leads to continuous uninterrupted stimulation of the vagal nervous system, the vagus nerve, which of course is very important in the body. It interfaces between the brain, the autonomic nervous system, and many muscles in the body, from the heart and the lungs to the voice production center. So this is bad stuff. You don't want it in your body.
It racks the nerves.
Right. But granotoxin contamination of honey occurs most often just in the Black Sea region of Turkey, especially from the plants Rhododendron ponticum and Rhododendron luteum. But rhododendron isn't the only plant to produce nectar containing granotoxin, which can filter down into the honey that the bees produce, of course. Honey containing granotoxin has also been found in North America, for example, in North Carolina, where in the 1950s, a sample was found to contain about 100 parts per million of granotoxin. And what did that come from? Well, the authors speculate it was probably derived from bees that ate the nectar of the mountain laurel, or Kalmia latifolia.
Hmm.
So I know if you're a honey fan, you're probably worrying like, oh no, am I going to get mad honey? Probably not, depending on where you are and how you get your honey. According to a Texas A&M University article citing anthropologist Vaughn Bryant, you can find honey in the United States, but not so often. So Bryant says, quote, normally there are not enough rhododendrons in one area for the bees to make concentrated mad honey. However, sometimes there is a late cold snap in the eastern U.S. that kills a lot of flowers, but doesn't seem to stun the rhododendrons. Thus, they're the only thing blooming, and the bees will focus all their attention on those flowers and produce concentrated mad honey during that period. These flowers are mostly in the Appalachian Mountains of the eastern U.S.
Okay.
That also goes with something I've read about this type of poisoning being more common in the early spring, when I guess also some of these granotoxin-producing flowers are, they're more cold-resistant, might bloom earlier where other flowers aren't available.
Hmm. Interesting. So it would be these rare instances where the poisonous flowers, the toxic flowers, are the only source for the bees.
Yeah, because the bees don't love them the most.
Right.
The bees would rather have another flower.
Mm-hmm.
But if all the other flowers are out of the game for some reason,
right,
they will go to the granotoxin plants and make their honey from that sweet, sweet nectar that some people have a taste for.
Hmm. Now, I'm guessing, too, that this is going to be more of a situation with your wild honeys.
Yes.
In these affected areas, and maybe with some like extreme indie honey, I guess.
Right. But you're probably not going to get this from a mass produced honey.
Right.
Because that involves, I mean, number one, there's just quality control. So they tend to know what types of flowers the nectar is coming from. But then there is also massive mixing involved. So when you get mass produced honey, they're blending together huge batches of honey from different hives. And even if there were some containing toxin, it would probably be mixed and thus diluted way down to a level that's not a threat.
Okay. So outside of the Black Sea region, you would have to really have a string of bad luck, I think, to run across this stuff, right?
Probably. I mean, you could come across, if somebody's like a wild honey collector, mm-hmm. you know, or like you said, extreme indie honey, and they don't necessarily know what they're doing, or they have some bad luck with mm-hmm. what flowers their bees have access to, and they don't realize it in time before they give it to somebody to eat. You could encounter mad honey, in other parts of the world, but it's definitely going to be most common in the Black Sea region, especially in Turkey. So if you eat some mad honey today, what's going to happen to you? Well, clinical characteristics, I'm going to list a few. This is back to Janssen et al. So there's hypotension, meaning low blood pressure, problems with cardiac rhythm, nausea and vomiting, sweating, dizziness, and quote, impaired consciousness.
Oh,
it's kind of a euphemism, right? there's also less often, but still noted, fainting, blurred vision, diplopia or double vision, salivation, convulsions, atrial fibrillation, cardiac arrest, and myocardial infarction, meaning a heart attack. All that really from a hit of bad honey? Yes, if you get enough of a concentrated dose you eat enough of it, you can have symptoms like these.
I would have liked to have seen a clinical list of symptoms that also included the various injuries that the Persian military would have yeah. inflicted on you in ancient times.
Side effects include massacre.
Yeah, dismemberment, etc.
but here's one more thing. Not all known cases of mad honey poisoning are accidental. Sometimes people take granotoxin-contaminated honey intentionally as an aphrodisiac or as an alternative medicine. And I think the jury's still out as to whether at low doses granotoxin may actually have some kind of positive effects. I think it's not clear yet whether that actually is effective. But the authors of the study I mentioned speculate that regularly taking contaminated honey for these reasons may lead to a condition called chronic mad honey intoxication syndrome. That sounds like a syndrome you don't want to have to put on your little form you fill out when you get a new doctor.
That's right. All right. On that note, let's take a quick break. And when we come back, we will discuss the dead man's fingers.
Shout out to Astapro for sponsoring this episode and providing us with free samples.
Rob, as the local host with allergies here, they sent you some of their nasal spray to treat your allergies. What was your experience like?
Yeah, that's right. I always wrestle with the pollen a bit when it rolls in during the spring. So they sent me the little nasal spray. I tried out the product and yeah, it sure did help me get on top of my symptoms for the day. And it's so fast acting, it was already kicking in before I left the house.
Astapro is a first-of-its-kind nasal allergy spray. It's the fastest 24-hour over-the-counter allergy spray. It starts working in 30 minutes, while other allergy sprays take hours. Astapro is the first and only 24-hour steroid-free allergy spray. Astapro delivers full prescription-strength indoor and outdoor allergy relief from nasal congestion, runny and itchy nose, and sneezing.
Get fast-acting nasal allergy symptom relief with Astapro. Go to astaproallergy.com for a discount so you can get Astapro and go today. Astepro allergy.com. Astapro and go. Use as directed for relief of nasal congestion, runny nose, sneezing, and itchy nose due to allergies.
Today's episode is brought to you by eBay. eBay Motors is here for the ride. Remember when you first saw the potential? And then, through some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Look to your left. Look to your right. It's official. No one's got a ride like this. There's nothing else that sounds like, feels like, or looks like the set of wheels in your garage. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly, so there's no limit to how far you can take it. Brake kits, turbochargers, engines, exhaust kits, roof racks, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, well, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
What kind of fun is waiting for you at Kings Island? The holy cow, we're way too high and here comes the drop kind of fun. The make a splash all summer kind of fun. the, I can't believe I ate that whole funnel cake. Let's get another kind of fun. But most importantly, at King's Island, you'll find for the fun of it kind of fun.
Don't wait to start your fun season. King's Island is now open on weekends.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can waste another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can conquer it. I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. Any road. The steeper, the better. Because my all-new Santa Fe is available with H-Track all-wheel drive, so I can hit the trail without a worry in the world. Heck, with three rows and best-in-class rear cargo space, I can pack the whole family in with all our gear. We've got available dual wireless charging for our phones, so we'll never lose touch with civilization, and we won't lose touch with the primordial power of Mother Earth. So which is it? Waste the weekend or do something a little more epic? And conquer it in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
All right, we're back. Robert, you have piqued my interest. Dead man's fingers? Are you literally talking about eating the fingers of a corpse?
No, but in a way, it's kind of figurative. So are you yeah, digitally, if you will. But here's the thing. Are you a crab fan? Do you enjoy eating crab?
I don't eat it that often, but I do like it.
What is the most crab-like form of your crab consumption? So do you enjoy soft shell crab on the sandwich, the legs and the claws sticking out on the sides?
It's another thing. I don't eat that often, but when I've had it, I've liked it.
Okay. It's my absolute favorite. I think it is the best way to eat an animal, where there's less deniability about what you're doing. You're biting into this crab.
The whole shape is there.
The shape is there.
You might as well eat a cockroach.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's the meat, but also all these other substances that are all fried up, all the other bits of its anatomy.
Right.
I feel like it's a very honest mode of consumption, even though it is cooked. So it's not like you're just eating the raw living crab.
No, I can get with that.
Okay. Well, this is, we're not just talking about crabs here, though. Of course, we're talking about the dead man's fingers, which if you've ever, actively engaged in the cooking of crabs and catching of crabs, then you probably have some degree of familiarity with what I'm talking about here. So in our last Dangerous Foods episode, we discussed, the manner by which, fugu, puffer fish, become edible via the skilled culinary removal of certain tetrodotoxin-laden innards.
Right. It's got certain organs that have especially high concentrations of this toxin.
Right. So you need a skilled chef to cut that little sliver out, cook it up, and it's good to go, right?
Yeah, but a good sushi chef will know what they're doing.
Right.
They'll be able to get it out of there, and you shouldn't have to worry about it if you're in good hands.
Exactly. So this is faintly similar to that, but this is definitely a category where we're going to be dispelling a lot of ideas about dangerous foods rather than, giving you the science behind why it's actually dangerous.
Okay. Well, you got to tell me where the name comes from.
Okay. As far as I can tell, the name itself is just kind of lost, to history. You know, we don't know like where, you know, what region this came from, but, you do find dead man's fingers in edible crabs. And it's wonderful fear marketing, right? You decided that you have this rotting hand of the drowned dead that's inside your food. And if you eat it, according to the urban legends, it depends on the legend what happens. Maybe you're going to become violently ill. Maybe you're going to contract a disease. I found people who said, oh yeah, when we were cleaning crabs as a kid, my parents or a big brother, you know, it depends who's screwing with you, basically.
Right.
And who's saying, oh, don't eat those parts. If you eat the dead man's fingers, you'll die, or you'll catch a disease, or you'll become violently ill. The versions are various. But I find the stories particularly interesting given our relationship with crabs, creatures that we have to keep alive and then cook alive in order to eat them. So it's perfectly strange that we summon this tiny rotting humanoid hand inside the body of our victim.
Yeah, that is a nice metaphor. Is like the hand that places them into the pot of boiling water comes back from inside the shell.
Yeah. So it's kind of beautiful in its own way. And in trying to figure this out, because I'm not going to spoil it just yet, if you don't know what the dead man's hand is, you might expect it to be something related to digestion, right?
Yeah, I'm guessing crab anus, or I don't know.
No, as far as I know, you eat that portion of the crab, at least with the soft shell crab. Mm. But you know, there are plenty of examples of animals for which we cast aside certain internal organs. Either out of necessity or just we don't want to bother processing them into sausages or dog food or whatever. Even the Komodo dragon will sling the intestines of a kill around in order to loosen the feces from the intestines so that they can eat them. So
weird.
Yeah.
I've never heard of that.
Yeah, it's pretty great because they don't like eating feces.
But they do want the large intestine.
Yeah, yeah, they're tasty. They'll eat everything but that. And the baby Komodo dragons, there's no child rearing in Komodo dragon culture. so the baby Komodos have to climb up trees to get away from the adults who will try to eat them. Uh-huh. But they've also been observed to smear themselves in feces, or at least they wind up covered in feces, and then the parents will not eat them because they're disgusting. So it's kind of like Predator with Arnold Schwarzenegger in the mud.
But they can't see them. They're just not tasty.
Yeah.
That would be a good interpretation on Predator.
Oh, yeah. What if all the mud was poop? And then the Predator is just like, ugh, yeah. I can't do this.
Exactly.
This is not
That's
fun
what
anymore.
Was going on the whole time. He could see him.
But, but based on all of this, it feels somewhat accurate that there would be this sickening, disease spreading, or even deadly portion of the common food crab, right?
Yeah. Oh, I would think so.
Yeah.
I
mean, it lines up with the puffer, at least, with the fugu.
Just intuitively looking at a crab, it looks like something that would have poisonous parts.
Yeah, you would look at it, it looks back at you, and you might ask yourself, can I eat all of this? Clearly not, because a lot of it's very, very hard and pointy.
Uh-huh.
So the fingers that we're talking about here are nothing more than the crab's gills.
Oh.
And this is where respiration and filtration takes place, and they consist of many different plume-like filaments arranged around a central axis. In the blue crab, for instance, there are 8 gills on either side. So, if you kind of squint at them, and I've looked at them when cleaning crabs and instructed by my in-laws who know what they're doing, and I do not know what I'm doing, but they tell me, oh, yeah, that's the dead man's hand right there.
Are they like crab country people?
Oh, yeah, yeah. My wife's family has Cajun blood, and her brother lives down in Ocean Springs, Mississippi. So yeah, they were like constantly crabbing, catching crabs, bringing them back. The whole family taking them apart, and it's good eating. But yeah, if you want to interpret it as such, the dead man's hand might look like a little diseased leprechaun claw or something, or two of them. Now, the reality here, of course, is the crab is an organism. So there's a lot going on underneath that shell, underneath where the shell would be if you're using a soft shell. The white muscle meat, that's the prize stuff. That's the stuff that gets picked away and put into other recipes. That's the stuff you might buy in bulk, pre-picked for an exaggerated price. Mm-hmm. But you also find all these other things. If you've ever cleaned a crab or if you've ever eaten soft shell crab, you know what I'm talking about.
There's just some weird, nasty sauce inside the carapace.
Potentially. A lot of it's open to interpretation because there's a yellowish mustard.
Okay.
That is the fat. In females, you'll find orange ovaries, and in males, you'll find small white testes. There's a stomach. There's a little gray heart. There are intestines. There is an anus. Everything you might expect to find when you are taking apart an animal. Certainly one that was just living before you boiled it up or whatnot. Uh-huh. And also, if you're eating a fried softshell crab right off the bun, you definitely encounter that yellow mustard fat and all these other ingredients.
So are you supposed to get rid of that stuff or what?
Well, the instructions vary. So, you know, some people are going to be very pure about the picked crab, right? Because that's the meat. And that if you're picking apart cooked crabs, you're just going to probably eat the meat out of it, right?
Right.
But it depends. I mean, most of this is edible. The fat is certainly edible. And with soft shell crabs, you just kind of bite into the whole thing and just eat it whole, like a monster.
Right.
At most, what is prescribed is that you remove the eyes and you remove the gills, the dead man's fingers. And it's not because they're poisonous, but because they're chewy and it's cartilage and they might be a bit bitter. But it's not a do or die situation. It's merely these are the parts of the crab that are not delicious and or are not fun to eat.
Okay.
but they're not poisonous. They don't carry diseases. And interestingly enough, you know, it also is going to depend on the culture. I ran across a wonderful Serious Eats article by writer Chi-Chi Wang. And she does this series titled The Nasty Bits, where she she talks about the nasty bits of various foods sources. And in particular, she talks about crabs in one of these. She cuts open a live crab and tries out crab miso or kani miso, which is this Japanese tradition that typically involves cooking a partially vivisected crab directly over a low burning flame.
Wow.
Yeah. It's like cooking it in its little shell after you just cut it open.
That's brutal.
It, well, I mean, it's all of it's brutal.
That's true.
but here's a quote from it because she sums it up really nicely. I poured a bit of sake into the shell. The grayish green contents bubbled vigorously over the small flame. I cooked the parts until they were just heated through, soft and rich, with a taste not unlike liver. The kani miso was a delight to eat right out of the shell, though I saved a portion of it to have on toast and yet another to have with rice. And it did look very, you know, very cool. We eat all sorts of weird parts of animals. Some are more acquired tastes than others, so it makes sense, especially in a, within Japanese cuisine, right, that is so dependent upon the riches of the ocean, that there would be a finer use of the crab innards here.
Well, I gotta respect that, but the dead man's fingers specifically, the gills. So you're saying not poisonous, nothing to this myth at all?
No, not poisonous, not going to cause a disease, not going to kill you. It's just a taste issue. It's the consistency of it.
And yet some would find even a way to appreciate that.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, there are diverse flavors to play with there beyond the white meat of the crab. And if you want to learn more about this, especially if you have access or obligations of surrounding live crabs and freshly cooked crabs and, and, you know, pulling them apart, I ran across a wonderful PDF from mathinscience.info. It's like an educational website.
Uh-huh.
And this particular PDF guides you through a, quote, edible dissection of a blue crab. And so it's kind of a combination between a, you know, like a school, like a biology class dissection,
mm-hmm,
and a culinary preparation.
Okay.
So it takes you through the creature's anatomy as you take it apart and also tells you what you can eat and how you go about eating it.
Well, I do think in general for people, if you're going to eat meat, if you're going to eat the mm-hmm body parts of an organism, I think it's good to familiarize yourself with that organism,
yeah,
and what the parts you're eating are and where they come from.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I think we do our animals a disservice when we distance ourselves from the source and the reality of our sustenance.
Yeah, if you just think about the meat that you're eating as a thing that arrives wrapped in plastic wrap.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, maybe with a mystical dead leprechaun hand in there at some point. So I'll include links out to both the Nasty Bits article as well as the edible dissection instructions on the landing page for this episode at stufftheblowyourmind.com.
Okay, Robert, I have a food to ask about.
Okay.
And I only know about it because of a line in Monty Python and the Holy Grail.
Okay.
I remember you remember the scene with the French character who's taunting Arthur and his knights.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's played by John Cleese, right?
Yes.
Yeah, and he
outrageous French knights.
Yeah, and yeah, so he gives a lot of great insults to the Knights of Camelot. And at one point, he alleges that their father smelled of elderberries. And I always found that funny, but it's one of those things where I'm sure you've had this experience where you find something funny without knowing what it means. It's just the sound of the words that mm-hmm makes you laugh. I've never seen an elderberry. I've never, as far as I know, never tasted an elderberry.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know what the deal with them is, but are they poisonous?
Yeah, this is an interesting, subject because elderberries are another example of a food item that can prove dangerous if you consume it raw and under the right circumstances.
Okay.
But it's also regularly and traditionally used, cooking for, in various consumable forms. It's been used in medicine for ages. It has, antioxidant properties. It's used to treat sinus infection, cold and flu. And then on the culinary side, it's been used in jams, pies, liqueurs, and according to BBC Good Food, it is a must for, quote, the famous German Black Forest ham that is salted and seasoned with spices, elderberries, and juniper berries.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. And the liqueur, in particular, it's actually similar to gin, which is created with juniper berries.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so it's similar to that. But this is elderberries is something you tend to pick wild, and it's especially a thing in traditional English cooking, because this is something you would run out to the hedgerow and you'd pick some elderberry and then you'd bring it back.
But not stand there at the hedgerow eating raw.
Right. Well, there are accounts of people eating it, and there are accounts of people eating it raw and not feeling any symptoms from it. But this is certainly not recommended.
Okay.
So the UK's Food Standards Agency recommends cooking elderberries to destroy toxins that are present in the raw berries. And it's also a general rule of thumb to avoid unripe berries. So generally the way this is going to work is that you're only going to deal with blue or purple berries, and you're going to avoid the red ones completely.
So they tend to like darken as they age.
Yes. Yeah. So you avoid the ripe ones. It's also a general good rule of thumb, pregnant, breastfeeding, individuals, as well as people with autoimmune deficiencies, are encouraged to skip elderberries because there is that possibility for, there's also a possibility for interactions with various, drugs. But generally speaking, if it's cooked, it's prepared properly, especially like, you know, jams, desserts, et cetera, it's not being consumed, on its own, then you're fine. It's been used, without incident, you know, for ages. There are different varieties of elderberry, and, the main ones that you encounter, there's, Sambucus nigra, which is, the European elder, also called the black elder. And that one is most often used for medicinal purposes. Mm-hmm. And then it's generally advised to avoid the dwarf elder, the Sambucus albus, completely.
And because he gives you a cursed magical stone.
Yeah, it sounds wonderful, the black elder in the forest. Meet the black elder at the hedgerow. But in terms of what's toxic here, the active alkaloids in elderberry plants are hydrocyanic acid and sambucine, and both will cause nausea.
Sambucine. Is there any connection to Sambuca, or are those just, is that a false cognate?
That may be a false cognate. I cannot say one way or another on that, but I doubt it. Okay, so far we've talked about mad honey, we've talked about dead man's fingers, we've talked about elderberries. What is next? Surely there's some exotic food item that you have for us to discuss here.
Well, Robert, I want to take you on a food poisoning mystery adventure.
Okay.
In 1970s England.
Okay. This is fitting to follow elderberry.
So in 1979... on the second day of the autumn term at a school in South London, bunch of schoolboys, all the boys there, lined up for a school lunch, including steak pie, gravy, boiled potatoes, cabbage and or canned carrots, followed by a dessert of apricots or something called, quote, syrup sponge pudding.
Oh, that sounds delicious.
If our British listeners can tell me what that is, I would love to know. Mm-mm-mm. Sponge pudding. Anyway, after this lunch, 78 boys who had eaten the school lunch became sick with things like abdominal pain or diarrhea or vomiting, headache, fever. 17 had to go to the hospital, and 3 of those were considered dangerously ill. 2 had what was reported as minimal pain, but, quote, diarrhea was copious.
Oh.
And what I'm quoting from here is the a 1979 edition of the Quarterly Journal of Medicine, an article by Mary McMillan and J.C. Thompson. Continuing, the 3 boys considered dangerously ill were comatose or in a stupor and had peripheral circulatory collapse when they were admitted to the hospital. The others admitted to the hospital had symptoms such as convulsive twitching or spasms, confusion, hallucination, and general delirium. Now, fortunately, nobody died. All of the boys were well enough to go back home within 6 to 11 days of admission, but with a few of them, it seemed very close. So what had made them sick? On to the hunt. Lab tests for bacterial and viral infection all returned negative, so it was not a microbial infection of any kind.
Okay.
Doctors also tested the boys' blood and feces to see if they could detect other toxic substances, for example, elevated levels of lead, arsenic, copper. They also looked for zinc because at the time zinc phosphide was used as a common rat poison. They looked for signs of organic compounds such as nicotine, organophosphorus, various pesticides and defoliants. All of it negative.
Okay, so have we ruled out the syrup sponge pudding yet?
No, not necessarily.
Still suspect. Okay.
No, all of these could be suspect. What if it was the gravy? We don't know.
Yeah, what's in gravy?
Finally, what's in school lunch gravy? Maybe the same thing that's in syrup sponge pudding.
Mostly circus animals, right?
Finally, one Dr. Mary Whitaker of the University of Exeter, as well as the authors of the study I just mentioned, Mary McMillan and J.C. Thompson, they determined the culprit. They found that the sick boy's blood plasma had a deficiency of something called pseudocholinesterase.
Okay.
Now, I got to explain a little body chemistry here. Cholinesterase is a naturally occurring enzyme in your body. It's in your blood plasma, and it's necessary for the correct functioning of an animal's nervous system. So your body, like other animal bodies, has a nervous system as its command center, and your muscles, skin, inner organs don't do much without the nervous system telling them to do it. And you shouldn't just think about this in the, you know, conscious, deliberate sense of using your brain to move your skeletal muscles to jump over a pothole or throw a bowl of soup at somebody or whatever it is you do with your body. This also applies to the unconscious functioning of most of your internal organs. They need electrical stimulation or inhibition from the nervous system. And these electrical signals are transported through the body through structures called synapses. Synapses, of course, we've talked about them on the show before, but they're the gateways between neurons or nerve cells. And they allow electrical and chemical signals to pass through. And so these signals are often carried by a chemical called acetylcholine. Meanwhile, you can stop these signals with a specific cholinesterase enzyme called acetylcholinesterase, which breaks down the acetylcholine that allows the passage of the signals. So you need both. You need both chemicals in your body to allow and regulate proper functioning of the nervous system. If you don't have enough cholinesterase to break down the acetylcholine, your nervous system is going to start to experience the equivalent of a street congested with lots of cars and the cars won't stop. Ooh. So you can experience negative effects all over the body as a result of the nervous system being unable to effectively inhibit signals firing across synapses.
Okay, so if this were a game of Clue, at this point we kind of know what the murder weapon was, but not who or whether what the murderer is. Is it the was it Colonel Syrup Sponge Pudding or General Gravy, or one of these other fine suspects?
Or in the British version, Reverend Gravy. good question. So the boys had been poisoned by something that inhibited the production of cholinesterase in their bodies, or it generally inhibited cholinesterase. Actually, I can't remember if it was the production or if it naturally lowered. Anyway, they had decreased cholinesterase. And this allowed the researchers to isolate the cause of the outbreak because they knew what in the meal had the ability to do that. Potatoes.
Oh.
Poison potatoes. And before you think, wait, who on earth would try to poison a group of English schoolboys with a weapon as pure and honest as the potato? The answer is nobody. It wasn't intentional at all. The poisoning was traced to a sack of old potatoes in the school kitchen that had been sitting around since summer, long enough to develop a formidable poison profile. The potatoes were poisoned by their very own nature. And this was backed up by interviews with the students, where it was later found that the only thing all of the students who became sick had in common was that they'd eaten the potatoes. For example, like a vegetarian student was poisoned, and the other things had different options about desserts and stuff. But all the sick boys had eaten those old potatoes from the summer term. So how on earth would an old potato from the summer term do something that crazy to your nervous system? Well, the everyday potato is the tuber of a plant called Solanum tuberosum, which is a member of the plant family Solanaceae, or the nightshade family, which of course you might recall is sort of known for its poisons. Eggplants, tomatoes, and some other fruits are also members of this family. Potato plants naturally contain a range of defensive poisons called glycoalkaloids, and two primary alkaloids in potatoes are called solanine and chacosine. And in most cases of potato poisoning, the solanine is the one that gets most often singled out by name as the primary cause of illness, but there are multiple glycoalkaloids at work. And these toxins can be found in many parts of the plant. So if you ever decide to grow a potato plant for yourself in your home garden, do not eat the fruit of this plant. Do not eat its flowers, and don't get it in your head to make yourself a nice cup of potato leaf tea, because all throughout the plant you will find the presence of these glycoalkaloid poisons that can do to you what happened to these South London schoolboys.
Oh, okay.
Now, most recorded cases of solanine poisoning do not end in death, but in some cases, especially where there are like aggregating factors such as malnutrition or starvation at play, solanine poisonings can be deadly. And I want to give a few examples from a book about food intolerance called Was It Something You Ate? By John Emsley and Peter Fell, published by Oxford University Press in 2002. They cite an example where during the Korean War, food shortages in North Korea forced people in many communities to survive on things like rotten potatoes. And in one area, 382 people became sick from solanine poisoning, of which 55 were hospitalized and 22 died. Symptoms included weak pulse, blue lips and ears, pale skin, enlargement of the heart and liver, swelling of the face, abdomen, and extremities. And death usually occurred within 5 to 10 days in the cases where people died. In the last stages before death, people experienced excitability and attacks of shaking all over the body, and they eventually died from respiratory failure, it's reported. And there are a couple of other cases in 1918 in Glasgow, Scotland. 61 people got sick with vomiting, diarrhea, and headache after eating potatoes. Of them, one boy died of strangulation of the bowel.
Oh.
And also in 1925, a family of seven was poisoned by green potatoes, and two of them died.
Well, Joe, at this point, I imagine a lot of our listeners are thinking, well, heck, we live in a French fry nation here.
Exactly.
We live in a fully loaded baked potato nation. This is bad news. I mean, we eat so much potato.
Yeah.
Our children eat so many potato products. How do we steer clear of this potato poisoning?
Are we begging for death?
Yeah.
How to avoid the Reaper solanine and its chemical brethren in hoods. No. So most potatoes are fine. This is a thing you really shouldn't worry about. And there are clear signals to look out for. And I'll tell you what they are. But there's no reason to freak out about potatoes in general. Potatoes do contain some amount of solanine naturally, and actually Dr. Harriet Hall over at Science-Based Medicine has a really good blog post about this, about general solanine content in potatoes. She writes, quote, "It's estimated that it would take 2 to 5 milligrams per kilogram of body weight to produce toxic symptoms," and she's referring to solanine there, the glycoalkaloids. "A large potato weighs about 300 grams and has a solanine content of less than 0.2 milligrams per gram. That works out to about 0.03 milligrams per kilogram for an adult, a hundredth of the toxic dose. I figure a murderous wife would have to feed something like 67 large potatoes to her husband in a single meal to poison him. Unless he's a phenomenally big eater, arsenic would be a better bet."
Huh.
So regular potatoes with normal solanine content, this is not something you need to worry about.
All right,
unless you're eating hundreds of potatoes.
And then you probably need to worry about all those
something
french fries.
Else. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. You'll probably have, I don't know, a reaction to the salt first or something. But properly farmed potatoes produced by experienced growers tend to be bred for really low glycoalkaloid and specifically solanine content in the tuber, much lower than you'd find in a wild potato. And according to that Emsley and Fell book I mentioned earlier, the average potato has maybe 3 to 6 milligrams of solanine per 100 grams of mass. So that might be a different figure than Hall had. But either way, this is not a threat. Most of this also is going to be on the outside near the peel. So if you peel the potato, you're probably getting rid of most of it. And the concentration of solanine in the potato tends to increase if the potato is bruised or exposed to light, which tends to cause greening. You've seen green potatoes before. Those are the ones you don't eat. Solanine is generally found in higher proportions in potatoes that are have turned green or especially have begun to sprout?
I think that, yeah, where I've seen the green potatoes the most have been the sort of science classroom potato experiments.
Yes.
Where you have it have toothpicks stuck in it and you're growing it out or something.
Yeah, and it's been exposed to light for a long period of time.
Or classic Mr. Potato Head, I imagine. Though I don't know that I've ever actually encountered one of those.
Oh, I've never thought about him being poison, but he probably is.
Don't
he sits out
that,
on the counter all day. Well, so you're thinking, how can I know to avoid this kind of poisoning? How do I keep the glycoalkaloids out of my body? Well, simple steps. Store your potatoes in a cool, dry place. Don't eat old potatoes. Don't eat a potato that is green or sprouting. Mm-hmm. And if you're in doubt, peel your potatoes because there is likely much more poison in the peel than in the starchy center.
All right. I feel better at this point. I was a little nervous. So now I feel better.
Okay. Another fun fact about the green potatoes, though, the green you see in a green potato that may be quite poisonous is not solanine or any other glycoalkaloid itself, but regular old chlorophyll, stuff that makes plants green. The solanine and the chlorophyll, they're just correlated. So if you see chlorophyll, it probably means there are metabolic processes going on in the potato that means it's probably been exposed to sun or something, which tends to increase the solanine content.
Okay.
One last historical side note. In the mid-1960s, researchers in the United States bred a new strain of potato that was known as the Lenape potato, and it was released in November 15th, 1967 by the Crops Research Division of the U.S. Department of Agriculture and the Agricultural Experiment Station of Pennsylvania, and it was a cross between some existing potato varieties selected to create a tuber perfect for making potato chips. Huh. So it had a high specific gravity, meaning a high solids content, lots of dry matter, and a resistance to common parasites and potato diseases such as late blight, potato scab, mild mosaic, and tuber necrosis from leaf roll and stem end browning. Don't potatoes have the best disease names?
They do. I mean, I guess they're just ready for it. They're always already a little bit grotesque, right?
Yeah. And it was also considered to make potato chips with good color, could make good potato chips even after it had been in cold storage.
Okay.
So new, superior potato breed.
This is the age of you want a pristine, just shining, like ivory white potato chip.
Yes.
Before we reach this age of like cool, multicolored potato chips.
Exactly. Yeah, people wanted it. It should look like it was made out of plastic. But unfortunately, there was a problem. The Lenape varietal was found to have a defect. It was poisonous, reportedly able to cause headaches, nausea, vomiting, fever, bad symptoms. And what was the culprit? Well, the potato naturally contained elevated levels of glycoalkaloids. So the Lenape potato was withdrawn from consumer production, production in shame. I don't think it actually ever made it to the stores, to the consumers themselves, or if it did, it was pretty soon after withdrawn. But reading up on this, I wanted to know it was my first occasion to check out a 1960s edition of the American Potato Journal.
Oh, yeah. This is your first experience. You'd not picked up this journal previously.
It's a fascinating journal. But also, I wanted to mention that I think because of its inclusion in an influential book, the story about the Lenape potato was often referenced in the 1990s during the first big debate on GMO crops.
Huh.
Though the poison potato itself was the product of more traditional plant breeding.
Yeah, like,
so.
Yeah, that's the thing, right? I mean, we've been with our cultivated agricultural products, we have been manipulating them for quite a while.
Exactly.
Regular levels, like non-genetic manipulation. I mean, and really by their virtue, I mean, it's still genetic manipulation. We've been manipulating these plants for ages.
Yeah, exactly. I think it was just generally considered an example of the dangers of what happens when you use science to mess around with pure natural foods. But of course, the other potato varieties that, you know, we know and love are the product of agriculture and breeding and, you know, scientific investigation into the Mendelian genetics of potato varietals. And a much less dangerous, you can produce a much less dangerous potato through these processes than the glycoalkaloid rich wild potato. So I'm not sure what kind of argument that makes, really.
So we're continuing to try and breed the Kwisatz Haderach of the potato, but there's always
the Bene Gesserit potato breeding cult.
There's always the chance you'll create these various monsters on the way, right?
I think so.
All right, we're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, we will jump into another dangerous food example. And yes, there'll be at least one more Dune reference.
Today's episode is brought to you by eBay. eBay Motors is here for the ride. Remember when you first saw the potential? And then, through some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Look to your left. Look to your right. It's official. No one's got a ride like this. There's nothing else that sounds like, feels like, or looks like the set of wheels in your garage. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly, so there's no limit to how far you can take it. Brake kits, turbochargers, engines, exhaust kits, roof racks, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, well, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
What kind of fun is waiting for you at Kings Island? The holy cow, we're way too high and here comes the drop kind of fun. The make a splash all summer kind of fun. The I can't believe I ate that whole funnel cake. Let's get another kind of fun. But most importantly, at Kings Island, you'll find for the fun of it kind of fun.
Don't wait to start your fun season. Kings Island is now open on weekends.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can waste another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can conquer it. I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. Any road. The steeper, the better. Because my all-new Santa Fe is available with H-Track all-wheel drive, so I can hit the trail without a worry in the world. Heck, with three rows and best-in-class rear cargo space, I can pack the whole family in with all our gear. We've got available dual wireless charging for our phones, so we'll never lose touch with civilization, and we won't lose touch with the primordial power of Mother Earth. So which is it? Waste the weekend or do something a little more epic and conquer it in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Snag a Job is where America goes to hire, with the deepest talent pool in hourly hiring. With access to over 6 million active hourly workers, Snagajob is the all-in-one solution for hiring high-quality employees who can cover all your needs. On demand, temp to hire, part-time or full-time. You name the position. Warehouse worker, retail associate, grocery store clerk, fitness trainer, baker, stylist, bellhop, podcast producer. Yeah, Snagajob's got a worker for that. With our easy-to-use platform, you're able to seamlessly post and fill available positions quickly, with a dedicated customer support team to provide all the help you need along the way. Kind of nice knowing you have a talent pool like that in your own backyard, right? Snagajob is the partner you need to keep your business running smoothly. So visit snagajob.com or text snag to 242424 to talk to an expert. Snagajob.com, where America goes to hire.
All right, we're back. So this is a big one, of course. I think everybody's run across an example of this. Someone saying the apple. The sweet, innocent apple, the everyday apple a day keeps the doctor away fruit. This contains seeds. And if you eat these seeds, you will become poisoned and you will die. Have you heard variations of this?
I don't know if I've been told I would die, but I've heard that the seeds contain poison. And I think in a limited sense, that is true.
Correct. I mean, it is true. It's one of, as we'll discuss, it's definitely one of these cases where you are not going to poison yourself eating the seeds of apples. It's just there's no record of this ever happening. And when you start looking at the math and the quantity of toxins in the seeds, it's just impossible.
Yeah, I think as with almost everything else we've talked about in this episode, the old adage in chemistry holds true. Mm-hmm. Or is it chemistry? Toxicology. The dose makes the poison.
Right.
Anything including water, including sugar, including whatever, anything in the correct dosage is poisonous. So the question is, how much of it are you getting?
Exactly.
And how little does it take to hurt you?
Yeah. So the reality here is that, yes, the seeds, pits, and stones of many varieties of fruit contain small amounts of cyanide. There are a number of forms of cyanide, and if you take enough of the wrong one or the right one, depending on what your goal is, you can suffer poisoning. Symptoms include headache, dizziness, fast heart rate, shortness of breath, and vomiting. This may be followed by seizures, slow heart rate, low blood pressure, loss of consciousness, and, you know, cardiac arrest and death. I mean, it's cyanide. It's a poison.
Right.
Now, apples in particular contain a compound called amygdalin in their seeds. And this is a cyanide and sugar based molecule. All right. So if you start chewing the seeds, your saliva enzymes, they hit this particular compound. They cut off the sugar part from the molecule, and the remainder then can decompose to produce the poisonous gas, hydrogen cyanide.
Yikes.
Yeah, which sounds crazy and definitely makes me think of that scene in Dune where the Duke bites into the poison tooth in his mouth and then breathes out in an attempt to kill his captors, to kill the Vladimir Harkonnen.
Oh, that's a good scene.
It's a great scene, yeah. And it makes you think, well, maybe you should just bitten into an apple and just...
He fails to kill Harkonnen,
he
right?
does. He kills Peter.
Oh, Peter DeVries.
Yeah, he's able to take out one of the baddies, but luck, pure luck, saves the Baron.
As you allude to, yeah, that scene would have been much more awkward if he'd been trying to hold on while I eat 60 apples.
Yeah, allow me to chew the, my final request is that you give me unlimited apple seeds to chew and you hang out really close to my face. That is not a Mintat created plan, a Mintat approved plan.
Okay, but so how many seeds does it really take?
Okay, so here's another case, like we did in a previous example, where you have to bust out some grams and milligrams.
All right.
So cyanide toxicity in humans, you're generally talking 0.5 to 3.5 milligrams per kilogram of body weight.
Okay.
So, you know, it depends on your body, how big you are. For a fatal dose, you'd need to hit at least 1.5 milligrams per kilogram of body weight. Okay, so that's kind of, so now you have a basic range of toxicity and death. The seeds of the apple themselves, you're looking at 3 milligrams of cyanide per gram of seeds, and one seed is approximately 0.7 grams. So you would...
So it'd be like 2-point-something milligrams of cyanide per seed?
Yeah. You would need to chew an absurd number of apple seeds to pull this off. And there are no reports of anyone actually doing it, either intentionally, you know, out of, I don't know, madness or accidentally. Even Johnny Appleseed running around chewing on apples all day was not able to kill himself.
But I think there are some other seeds in natural fruits that we eat all the time that are a little bit more dangerous than apple pits, right?
This is true. And there's actually an excellent article that came out in The Guardian last year, actually. Really good. It has a wonderful chart that just shows you the different levels of cyanide in these different fruits. I'll have to include a link to it on the landing page for this episode at stufftoblowyourmind.com. But the basics are that... apple seeds with 3 milligrams per gram, that places apples somewhere in the middle of our spectrum, between the 0.1 milligram per gram of the common nectarine, so that's the low end, up to the 17.5 milligrams per gram in the European green gauge plum.
I've never heard of that.
Yeah, I had not either. It's a European specialty, and it's, yeah, that's a big one. Likewise, the apricot is pretty big too. The kernels of the apricot, 14.4. And there have been plenty of cases of problematic ingestion of apricot kernels, typically by children, as well as cherry pits are another one. Cherry pits have 3.9.
Now with those, I think I've read that you have to do some processing to make them especially dangerous, right? Like if you chew up cherry pits or something, they're more dangerous.
That's right. So remember the saliva that I mentioned earlier in the apple seeds. So there's that breaking down and the separation of that compound. So yeah, chewing the seeds, chewing the kernel. Also, I've heard that if you were to just grind up a bunch of cherry pits, you might have a similar scenario as well. I mean, you would have a similar scenario. So those are those are the areas where there's more concern. And generally that means that the concern with cherries, for example, is going to be improper food preparation, like somebody who has no idea what they're doing and they grind up a bunch of cherries for something without removing the pit. Or it's a case where a child gets a hold of a bunch of kernels from apricots or a bunch of cherry pits and starts chewing them. Those are situations where the condition often escalates and there is some serious toxicity that a doctor has to deal with.
Well, I got to invite y'all over for a taste of my fresh made pasta with home ground apricot pit pesto.
But it is one of these situations where, yeah, the average person might not realize that the average cherry with the pit in it does contain bits of cyanide, and you could have a lethal dose of cyanide in your house. It's just, if you're following the rules, you're going to be throwing all that cyanide out.
Right. If you eat it the normal way, there's no danger.
Right.
But this is maybe a good reason why. I remember when I was a kid there being games about spitting fruit pits. Did you have games?
I feel about like spitting fruit pits.
Yeah, it's like you know how far can you spit the watermelon seeds?
Oh, not yes, with watermelon seeds.
Not
definitely.
Saying they're dangerous, but mm-hmm. maybe the same is true of cherry pits and stuff like that. Maybe yeah. this is a way of culturally preserving the instinct to not chew up and swallow those poisonous apricot pits and cherry seeds.
Huh. Well, you know, I was thinking about this when we first discussed this, because just last night, my son, he's 4 and a half, he eats all the time, and I was giving him some orange slices to eat in the bathtub, because there has to be some overlap. Otherwise there would be no going to bed. And he's especially recently, he's been very demanding about how he doesn't want seeds in anything. And I bring him the fruit and he says, do these have seeds in it? I don't want the seeds. And I explain, if you take the seeds out, you spit the seeds out. This is how fruit works. Mm-hmm. and you just have to roll
spit
with this
them
method.
Into the bath.
Yeah. Well, not into the bath. No, he asked the same thing. I can just spit them in the bath. No, you can't spit them in the bath. Just spit them back in. This is why you have a bowl with fruit in it. But I wonder, like, to what extent this is a natural instinct for young children, especially to be appalled by the seed, because in fact, the seed of some fruits could prove dangerous to them.
Yeah.
You know, in the same way that I've heard there's some theories about picky eating in children that basically amounts to the same thing, that picky eating in children is a natural inborn defense mechanism against potentially dangerous foods that are going to be more dangerous for them given their small body size.
That's funny, because I see the exact same evolutionary process working itself out in some babies and in my dog, where it seems mm-hmm. like just anything that will fit in the mouth will go in there.
But then come back out, right? Sometimes with the dog?
Oh, yeah, sometimes. I mean, I don't know. My dog wants to eat things that I often think, like, that doesn't make biological sense to have a drive to try to eat that rock.
Well, am I correct in this, that with dogs, like, that's part of their tasting process, like to judge the food, it goes in the mouth first?
Oh, yeah, I guess that kind of makes sense.
Yeah, I could be wrong on that. I'm not a dog expert, but yeah. But at any rate, the whole incident here with seeds also comes up, I understand, with some pets. I didn't really explore that thread, but I was seeing a number of different posts and articles out there about, do I need to be concerned about my dog eating these pits?
Well, there's certainly lots of foods that are probably not dangerous to you, but might be dangerous to a pet for a couple of reasons, mm-hmm. For different body chemistry, but also just because of different body size. A serving that contains nothing all that, you know, nothing in concentration dangerous to you mm-hmm. might be a big dose for a small animal.
Right. Yeah. Especially a small dog, small cat, et cetera. All right. You know, on a final note here, you know, so many of the things we've been talking about like the dosage level, the quantities, keep in mind the spice rack, okay? We actually have an older episode of Stuff to Blow Your Mind that is all about nutmeg. Nutmeg, and I encourage you to check that episode out, because nutmeg is fascinating. It has this weird, wonderful history full of, like, Eastern medicine, European fashion, medieval manipulation of the humors, also, like, bloody colonial monopolies.
I've definitely read about its use as a recreational drug.
Yeah, there. Malcolm X wrote about its use in prisons. You would take a matchbox full of nutmeg, and you would have you know, an altered state. Huh. There are various other accounts from history. Samuel Pepys wrote about an individual who took nutmeg and ran naked through the streets of London.
Samuel Pepys?
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So there's a lot, there's a rich history with nutmeg. But yeah, nutmeg is an example of something where if you use just a few sprinkles here and there on top of your eggnog or whatever, and it's perfectly fine. I put a little on my smoothie every morning. Uh-huh. But if you take larger quantities, there can be toxic effects.
Spice trance.
Yeah, spice trance, essentially. Except a very unpleasant spice trance, with lots of nausea and like a really horrible hangover. Now, I've read no accounts of recreational nutmeg use beyond sprinkles for flavoring that end well. It's all grotesque and nobody tries it a second time, for the most part, unless they have no other option and are just extremely bored. But it serves as a fine lesson, because if you look at your spice rack in your house, you are looking at a number of different substances that are in many cases toxins. They evolved in the original plants that they came from as a deterrent to keep people from eating them, or to keep people from eating them beyond, you know, certain portions.
Yeah. In many cases, the pungency and flavor that we prize them for when applied at a very small amount in our food is by itself disgusting.
Yeah.
It's by design disgusting. It's supposed to be that way as a defense mechanism.
Yeah. Food technology is essentially our mastery of all of these elements. We figured out how to manipulate them, how to change them, often with fire, and then utilize even these potent poisons in very small quantities that changes the flavor. So yeah, anything on your spice rack, if you took it in sufficient quantities, you in many cases could have an altered experience, probably not a good altered experience, but an altered one, and or experience toxic effects. So it's just, you know, worth keeping in mind. I think nutmeg is a great example of that. And I love nutmeg. And yet I would definitely not advise eating a matchbox full of it.
Okay. So main takeaways from this episode: don't eat the green potatoes.
Right.
The dose makes the poison.
Mm-hmm.
Don't grind up cherry or apricot pits and make a pesto out of them.
Mm-hmm. Don't freak out over the dead man's fingers, though, you know, take them out for flavor purposes.
Don't eat 4 cups of nutmeg.
Yeah. I mean, basically the take home is don't take your food for granted. Have some basic idea of where food comes from, the processes that lead it to your plate, the organisms that they stem from. Like, if you have, the more you know about what your food actually is, the less shocking any of these dangers are.
Yeah.
And also the better prepared you are for these, for the often, you know, small chances that you might encounter these problems.
I think that's a really good point. Maybe that's the main takeaway from this episode. When you think about your food, think about organisms. Don't think about it as a product that came from a factory, though in mm-hmm. many cases it probably was, you know, if it's a packaged product, probably was processed in a factory somewhere.
Right.
But it is an organism, or derived from an organism. Think about the organism it came from, the plant, the animal, whatever it is. Think about its place in nature, all the things that fed it and grew its bones, as it in turn feeds you and grows your bones and hopefully doesn't poison you.
And I think that's a perfect message for the holidays. So on that note, if you would like to certainly check out any of the links we mentioned here, that older episode on nutmeg, last year's episode on dangerous foods, etc., you can check all of that out at stufftoblowyourmind.com. You'll also find blog posts, you will find videos, you will find links out to various social media accounts as well.
And if you want to get in touch with us directly, as always, you can email us at blowthemind@howstuffworks.com.
For more on this and thousands of other topics, visit HowStuffWorks.com.
Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. The future of wireless is here, and it's transparent. Switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless visible. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon. Just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. No hidden fees, no surprises, no, really.
What are you waiting for? Get with the times and switch to Visible at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan for data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com.
What kind of fun is waiting for you at Kings Island? The holy cow, we're way too high and here comes the drop kind of fun. The make a splash all summer kind of fun. The I can't believe I ate that whole funnel cake. Let's get another kind of fun. But most importantly, at Kings Island, you'll find for the fun of it kind of fun.
Don't wait to start your fun season. Kings Island is now open on weekends.
Hey, guys, you know what this playground could use? A wine country, huh?
A redwood forest would be cool.
Ski slopes!
Wait! Did we just invent California?
Discover why California is the ultimate playground at visitcalifornia.com.
Open a limited-time 11-month certificate at Kemba Financial Credit Union. At 5.25% APY, it's more than triple the national average, plus it's a safe and secure way to grow your money. Visit your local branch or kemba.org/cd for details. Offer expires May 31st, 2024. APY equals annual percentage yield. Restrictions apply. $500 minimum and $250,000 maximum deposit. Advantage status required. Comparison based on bank rate average. Federally insured by NCUA.